Chuck, I'd like to start with economic apartheid in America. Why the term economic apartheid? Does it really apply? Is our social stratification that bad that it's comparable to apartheid?
I think we're drifting toward an apartheid, and it's probably more subtle in that we think we've had an economic boom when in fact it's a very uneven economic boom, and the trends that we see are, rising prison construction, gated residential communities, a sense of social polarization, a division within communities and between communities that really is very different than 30 years ago. So I think we're drifting toward a much more polarized apartheid society.
And you've been working with United for a Fair Economy. Just for the listeners, can you tell me a little bit about what you do there?
Yeah, we're a national organization that was formed 6 years ago to draw attention to the dangers of growing income and wealth inequality. And we do education programs for schools and religious congregations and business and labor groups. We do some advocacy on public policies that would lessen inequality, and we do some research and reports related to those themes. And we're trying to help people who are concerned about this issue find each other and work together to make the economy work for everybody.
Has it been working very well for you?
Yeah, it's been, I think we've come in a very short 5 years, we've come a long way. I think that the recognition of the income gap is much greater. I think there's still a lot of work to do to for us to understand the whole dimension of the wealth and savings gap. I think one of the things that will happen is if there is an economic recession, some of these inequality trends, I think, are masked by the fact that people are working longer hours and putting more and more basic expenses on credit. And when there's a downturn, all of a sudden the sort of mask will be pulled off, and we will find that the new economy has a real downside, and it's related to this pulling apart.
Now, as far as the wealth and savings gaps go, how are those laid out?
Well, one way it plays out is at the very top end, the richest 1% of households now has about 42% of all the private wealth, which is double the share they had about 25 years ago. So more wealth is concentrated in fewer hands. And in a democracy, that's a problem because concentrated wealth is concentrated political power, the power to write the rules and shape the culture of our society. How it plays out for people, say, in the middle or lower and middle income people is less savings, less retirement security. The wealth gap means that we're seeing a declining savings and standard of living for people in the middle. So people who used to be in the middle had more per capita savings and more opportunities in terms of purchasing a home and that sort of thing. We're starting to see those opportunities diminish for a growing number of people.
Now, proportionally, have the different classes, we'll say the working class, the middle class, and upper class, have they proportionately stayed about the same size? Has the mean income, for example, still stayed with roughly the same number of Americans or the same percentage of Americans, or is that changing?
Well, if we take, well, what's interesting to look at is in the 30 years after World War II, every fifth, from the lowest income fifth to the highest income fifth, saw their incomes double over those 30 years, from 1947 to 1977. In the 25 years, in the last 25 years, the richest top, 10% has pulled away, seen their income double. The bottom 40% has actually seen their real incomes, taking out inflation, decline, people moving backwards. And the middle has stood still. And that's the last 4 years, the middle class has finally gotten back to the starting line in terms of real income, real weekly wages, that during the 80s and early 90s, real wages plummeted. So even after a 10-year economic boom, the household in the middle is just trying to get back to the starting line when Richard Nixon was president.
I'm reading over a summary of economic apartheid in America that mentions the government and corporate rule changes that have favored the wealthy and excluded the poor over the year. Could you give me some details on exactly how this has been done and how can it be changed?
Well, this kind of gets to the root of the question of how did this happen? You know, and some people would say, well, technological change, or, you know, this is just sort of like the laws of nature, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. And our analysis is that growing inequality in America is the result of a shift in power, that on the one hand, the power of global corporations and wealthy donors has increased, the power of communities and workers and consumers has sort of decreased, and as a result of that, the rules that govern the economy, tax policy, global trade policy, Federal Reserve policy, what Alan Greenspan does, all those rules have been very good to asset owners, substantial wealth holders, and not particularly good for people who work for wages. So the rules have been tilted in the last two decades in a way that has put at risk the standard of living for the vast majority of people. But it's also good news, which is the rules can be changed to make the economy work for everybody. We can raise the minimum wage. We can have a tax policy that's fair to working families, not just favoring the wealthy. You know, these things are in our control. We just need to have the political will and the sort of informed citizenry to ensure that that's possible.
And I'd imagine the patience to see the process through.
Yeah, but if you think, boy, the shift in wealth has happened in two decades. There's no reason why we couldn't, as a society, say, we think growing polarization is a dangerous direction for us as a democracy. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for civic life. Let's place a higher value on not being so polarized as a society. Let's do what we did after World War II. Let's expand home ownership, expand savings, give a generation of people a debt-free college education. All those would be very good investments in a society that shares prosperity and has real equality of opportunity.
Now, in the book, you've called for a broad social movement to prevent or combat economic apartheid, and I'm wondering how you see things like the WTO and IMF protests in sort of perspectives of a broad social movement of this kind.
Well, I think that the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle and the protests around that were a good example of a rumbling in the land. I think that this emerging social movement is happening. It's you can see it in the student movement, students saying we don't want our clothing made in sweatshops. You can see it in the religious communities where people are saying we need to have a moral discussion about the economy. This is not, you know, how much growth there is and how much riches there are for the rich is not the moral measure of an economy. The moral measure of an economy is how the least of us are doing. And so there's this organized rumbling, and the Seattle protests and the street protests are the most visible sort of eruption of that, but there's a lot of other less visible sort of below the radar screen work that's going on that I think is leading to will lead to some fundamental changes in the coming decade. One way to think about it is I think we should be preparing for an economic downturn, and that is an opportunity to talk about what kind of economy and what kind of society we should have, and work to make, you know, our elected officials accountable to everybody, not just the donors who give them the big contributions.
This goes back to, again, the synopsis of economic apartheid that I'm looking at. The statement was made in it that the religious, neighborhood, cultural, and political threads that held communities together are beginning to fray with family workers or family members working longer hours. How is that happening?
Well, what's happening is that in order to maintain a standard of living, people are working two jobs, or more people in a household are working two and three income earners, you know, supporting a household, whereas, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, one paycheck was enough to have a decent life. And what that means is that people have less free time. They have less free time to spend caring for children or elders or participating in civic life. And that sort of backfires on having a healthy society. If people are working so much, they just don't have slack to go to a civic meeting, to participate in a religious congregation, to care for the elderly neighbor who maybe needs their sidewalk shoveled or whatever. And that, I think, leads to a sort of fragmentation and a sense that, oh, you know, that we're on our own. We're all just individuals out there like asteroids circling in the outer space, and that's a myth. You know, we're really fundamentally interconnected, and one inaction on the part of some hurts other people. And that's we need to go back to remembering the core values of this country and what it is that we should, that's important. And this new economy has a certain set of values and a culture that I think is very alien, really, to people. It's just, you know, let's get as much money, take the money and run. Let's accumulate as much as we can today, and let's not think about the consequences for anyone else. And that's not a healthy culture.
I'd imagine that the people who most benefit from the status quo have really enjoyed this process.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that many of the beneficiaries are starting to speak out about the dangers of growing inequality. We started a project called Responsible Wealth that has 450 business leaders, people who are in the richest 5%, who are saying, you know, this is not the kind of society I want to live in or that I want my children to grow up in. I don't want to live in an apartheid society. And that ultimately these economic trends are bad for everybody, even the people we think would benefit them from them. And an interesting thing we're involved with is, you know, the Congress and the Bush administration are going to try to repeal the estate tax in the next couple months, the tax on the very wealthy inheritances. And we have put together a very interesting group of people who you will not expect to have heard speak out on this issue. And in the next couple weeks, you'll be hearing from them. And it'll raise a lot of eyebrows. But you're going to hear from some of the wealthiest and prominent families in this country speaking out about against the repeal of the estate tax.
What else is in the future for United for a Fair Economy?
Well, I think that we're going to be very involved in making sure that the new administration doesn't push through policies that will worsen inequality in America. We're concerned about President Bush's proclivity to give tax cuts to the rich, school vouchers, things like that. We're also keeping an eye on the global front. There's a new treaty, the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, which is being negotiated now. It's essentially NAFTA for the whole hemisphere. And in Quebec in April, there will be a summit meeting of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We hope to have tens of thousands of people there to basically protest and say that treaty should not worsen standards. It should lift standards. So, and if people are interested, if it's okay, I'll give a web address, which is www.ufenet.org. It's a website, ufenet.org, that has information on these different things. Or if you don't have a website, you can call. We have a toll-free number, which is 877-JOIN-UFE. And we can send out an information packet on how people can be involved in working on these concerns.
Thanks again for the call, Chuck.
Thanks, Rob.